This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
So last week, we talked to Dr. Lyle. We had a great show. We talked to Dr. Lyle, a psychologist, about some of the underlying principles of human behavior that can influence our long-term happiness. And today we're actually going to get a little bit more specific about a pretty large topic, and that topic is self-esteem. More specifically, as Dr. Lyle calls it, the stepping stones to self-esteem. But before we get to that, a number of you emailed me. Actually, you guys wanted to know a little bit more about our guest, Dr. Lyle, and his educational background in psychology. Like I mentioned last show, Dr. Lyle has been a psychologist for about 30 years. He graduated from UC San Diego in California, which is actually a couple of hours away from where I'm broadcasting right now. But after he graduated, he received a fellowship to the University of Virginia, where he completed his PhD. And after he was appointed lecturer in psychology at Stanford University, and he also went on to be on staff for the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder at the VA Hospital in Palo Alto. He's worked as a forensic psychologist in Dallas, Texas, and as a consultant for the National Institute of Health Clinical Trials on Cognitive Therapy.
So let's listen in as Dr. Lyle talks to us about self-esteem.
Yes, okay. I'll sort of describe self-esteem a little bit of the history of it and also kind of what it really is. Psychologists have generally been pretty puzzled about self-esteem. They've almost had two ways of thinking about it, and we're going to find out that those two ways, that it makes sense that they think about it in two separate ways. But if you think about how some of the things that you have heard about self-esteem, you've heard sort of two very different concepts. One is that, you know, self-esteem is just something that you can give to yourself, and that that we don't, you know, it's not about what other people think, and that it's just something that's inside you, and you're the one that has to fix it. On the other hand, we also hear that you get your self-esteem from parent-child interactions. So we see a contradiction immediately in the way psychologists mostly think about self-esteem, is that on the one hand, they're saying that it's an independent thing, that it doesn't have anything else to do with what other people think, and secondly, it seems to have everything to do with what your parents thought of you and those interactions. So we see right away that there's a confusion among psychologists about how this would work. What you won't see in psychology is you're not going to see any theory about why there is such a thing as self-esteem. That has been sort of something that's not typically addressed or even really thought about. It's just some writers have thought that self-esteem is a need, kind of like a vitamin, and if you don't have enough of it, bad things happen. So this was actually the center of the self-esteem movement in the 1960s and 1970s, and one of the chief architects of that discussion was a man by the name of Nathaniel Brandon. And Brandon, along with people like Abraham Maslow and the humanists, basically had this idea that people had a need for esteem, and if that need was frustrated, then people would suffer as a result. And so, and the suffering that they would do would essentially decompensate in some important ways, like they might get into drugs or do criminal behavior and so on and so forth. So it was essentially seen as a something essentially a judgment that one makes for themselves, and that that judgment, we're not sure where it comes from, but that if it's a negative judgment, then this has terrible consequences. Got it.
So
okay.
Around what time were all these ideas that self-esteem was a vitamin, around what time frame was that?
1960s, 1970s, even 1980s, even later.
Okay.
So it wasn't actually until the 1990s that we got our first clarity on the topic of self-esteem, and it came through the laboratory of the social psychologist Mark Leary, who was at, I forget where he was. I think he was at, I'm forgetting where he was, but now he's at Duke. Anyway, I think he's at Wake Forest when he ran this research. What Leary did was he almost accidentally tripped over very important truth. What he did was he had college kids interact with each other, and they got, then at the end of the interaction, he would give people individually, he'd give them feedback. He'd say, hey, people in the group really enjoyed the conversation, the discussion that was going on, and they're actually thinking about getting together next week to sort of have more discussions. And then he would say the following, or they would give the following feedback. I don't know how they did it. That you, the subject, was either invited or you weren't invited. So, in other words, you were either included or you were being rejected by the group. And in this study, they had various measurements of different things. But one of the measurements was on what they thought was self-esteem. And what they discovered was that the self-esteem of people that had been rejected plummeted as a result of this failure feedback. And Leary looked at this, didn't expect it, because the concept of self-esteem has been almost like it's something that's a little bit, it's like your internal sculpture of you. It's kind of like, it starts out in ivory, and it's carved a little bit at a time by your parents. And then if you have a lot, if you have a really beautiful self-esteem, then you've got a really beautiful self-esteem. And if you've got a hacked-up self-esteem, you've got a hacked-up self-esteem. But what an individual group of people that you just interacted with for 20 minutes, whether they reject you or accept you, shouldn't be having any appreciable impact on your self-esteem at all, according to traditional self-esteem theory. However, turns out to not be true. Turns out that Mark Leary's research shows that self-esteem is actually highly dynamic, can change very, very quickly. And so after he published this research, he actually analyzed this, and he said, listen, we haven't been looking at self-esteem from an evolutionary perspective, but if we did, we start to appreciate that human beings evolved in small packs or small groups, and whether or not you are included in the pack was unbelievably important in terms of your statistical likelihood of survival and reproduction. That if you were rejected out of the pack, then you were very likely facing death. So as a result, you should have a mechanism or a meter, a device, like a thermometer, inside your head for tracking whether or not you are accepted or rejected by members of the group. And so he called it, he said, listen, this is what we're going to call a sociometer. And this is what the self-esteem mechanism is it's actually a sociometer. And so this was actually a profound critique of previous thinking on self-esteem, because self-esteem thinking was that, in fact, this is all an internal, quiet, personal judgment of yourself. And Leary's saying, no, that's not true. Actually, it's a very social psychological mechanism having to do with what other people think of you. And the advice that psychologists have generally had, which is, and your parents will basically say things like, well, who cares what other people think? You can't be paying attention to what other people think. But in fact, Mark Leary is saying, well, actually, the self-esteem mechanism is designed by nature to be sensitive to what other people think. And in fact, it's absolutely essential for your survival and reproductive success in order to be paying very close attention to what other people think. And you need a mechanism for doing that to give you feedback on a feeling level that tells you, just like you have the hunger drive and just like you have a thirst mechanism and a temperature detection mechanism, so must you also have a sociometer, a method that your nervous system can pick up cues from other people to find out whether you're being accepted or rejected. This would be essential for a social animal to know when their moves that they were making in the village were gaining them points or losing them points. So if you're cracking jokes and people like them, great. And if you are cracking jokes and they're not liking them, you better be able to pick that cue up. If you dye your hair purple and everybody shuns you, then you better not do that again. So,
or do you have to find a new village?
Or you got to find a new village. And in the Stone Age, there wasn't a new village.
So I mean, I think in a lot of people's lives, we're interacting with so many different people. If we were to pay attention to what every single person said, it would be exhausting. And it would be, I mean, what I'm thinking is it would be exhausting that you'd never be able to get anything done.
Right. Yes. And so, but the point is that nowadays what you have is you have your own little village that you are thinking about in your own head. And so there's some X number of people and X characteristics of other people that you are tracking what you think that they would be thinking of you. And and so you're actually, so I don't, you know, no offense to the Hell's Angels, but I really don't care what they think of me. Now, as we broadcast this, they'll probably crack me down and burn down my house, okay? I hope they don't, you know. Hey, they're nice guys, okay? But the point is that there's, if you think about what we're trying to actually understand here, in the same way that we're trying to understand, if you're a biologist and you're a physiologist, you're trying to understand how knuckles work and how, you know, toenails work, how the knee joint works and how kidneys work. We're trying to understand how the mind works. And so the mind has parts to it. It has knuckles and joints and kidneys, et cetera. It has all kinds of specialized capabilities. And the mind is not just an amorphous mass of learning mechanisms like the behaviorists thought it was. The mind is, in fact, an incredibly diversified, nuanced set of tissue and with thousands and thousands of different specialized capabilities, just the way the body is built in the same way. And it's going to turn out that one of those pieces of tissue inside your brain is going to be the sociometer that Leary is talking about. And so the sociometer is clearly extremely sensitive to social feedback. This is not going to be true if there's something wrong with you, like you're autistic, and you are not paying attention to those cues. Doesn't make any difference. Now, much to the chagrin of your parents and everybody else, because you've got your elbow in your soup and you're you know, going up to the woman with the big breasts and putting your hands on them, like you're just doing all kinds of stuff that you're not supposed to be doing because you are not sensitive to those cues. Normal human beings with a normally healthy functioning brain are very sensitive to both acceptance and rejection cues from other people. And what they generate is feelings. By the way, when Leary published, he was roundly criticized in social psychological circles because he had, you know, i.e. used young college students who would be hypersensitive to their peers and blah, 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 and this will not. You know, if he used grown-up people with very high senses of self, they wouldn't have been so sensitive. So he knew that they were wrong. This was just a completely unprincipled, unbiologically informed criticism of him. And Leary had clearly identified a universal mechanism in human nature. And what he did then is he went and handpicked a whole slew of people that had been judged by both their peers and themselves as highly independent that don't give a damn what anybody thinks. So he got a group of those people and he put them in those same kind of groups and he gave them the same failure feedback and they had exactly the same response on their self-esteem scales as everybody else had had. So this is, in fact, a universal characteristic of human nature. And if anybody ever says, well, I don't care what people think, you just cared about what somebody thought or you wouldn't have uttered that sentence. Now, so the point is that we are designed to be very aware and sensitive to what other people think. That doesn't mean we twist ourselves in a pretzel for their approval. You know, we run cost-benefit analysis on who they are, how much approval we want, what it's going to cost us. However, we are very sensitive to this. Now, so O'Leary's work was a revolution in the field of self-esteem theory, but there would be more. So if we actually move on a little bit, we're going to circle back around to this ancient dilemma that psychologists have had about self-esteem. First of all, we have to let's also break down what self-esteem largely is, or the experience of it. What it is the feeling. It's a feeling that people have. And that feeling is very much akin to confidence. And so it's a device, just like all feelings are devices. Feelings are signaling devices that the nervous system has to tell you whether circumstances are beneficial or harmful for your survival or reproductive prospects. So when you're too cold, when you have a feeling of being cold, that's to motivate you to get warmer. When you're hungry, it's a feeling to motivate you to eat. When you're lonely, it's a feeling to motivate you to associate with other people. And when you're scared, you are motivated to try to remove threats. So every feeling that you have is a device to tell you to do something. Okay? If you're bored, it's a feeling to tell you to seek something that is more profitable for survival and reproductive prospects and engage in some process that's, i.e., more interesting. So your feelings are a guidance system, an extremely elaborate and subtle guidance system that is trying to orient you towards threats and opportunities in your environment and to create impulses in you that are directed towards optimizing your life experience in a way that optimizes survival and reproductive success. One of the most important of those orienting mechanisms is being sensitive to what other people think. So how it is that you feel this self-esteem mechanism is largely a result of you tracking the cues that you are getting from other people about what they think of you. So, and incidentally, when you are when your self-esteem is quote low, we have a word for that. It's called being depressed. So psychiatrists and psychologists sometimes think that depression is some kind of a disease, some kind of malaise that just sort of, you know, lands on people for no apparent reason. This is utter nonsense. Depression is a feeling. And just like every other feeling, it has a biological purpose, and its purpose is to signal that you are not getting good feedback cues from your social environment. That's what causes people to be depressed. They can also be depressed about their own personal survival. You know, they just got news that they've got terminal cancer. That will also make people depressed. But most depression, most of the time, is caused by social cues that tell people that they are struggling in one of the three major domains in human life. And the three major domains of human life are, number one, mating, number two, friendship, and number three, trade. These are the three ways that human beings solve the problems of survival and reproduction. They solve survival problems by making friends and trading. They solve reproduction problems by selling mates on the idea of mating with them, as well as mating behavior would also be, for example, raising your children is, in fact, mating behavior. So so family processes are also under reproduction. So as a result, you are designed by nature to track cues from your social environment that tell you whether or not you are getting successful feedback, that others want to engage in trades with you. So, for example, as I explain many times, I have never seen the following client. The client is healthy. It is in no pain. The work that they do is ethical and understood in the marketplace to be excellent work, and they are engaged in a great deal of profitable trade, and they're well respected and well compensated. They have warm friendships with people that they admire and respect, that admire and respect them, and they have a romantic, sexual, exciting relationship with a mate that they consider very attractive, who also considers them very attractive, and both of them feel lucky to have found that mate. I have never seen an individual that walked through my door with all three of those situations firing on all cylinders and telling me, "I don't know what's wrong, Dr. Lyle, I'm depressed." Never happened. Okay. Now, it might happen. I've only been doing this kind of work for 35 years, so you never know. But when people walk through that door and they're depressed, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that their depression is centered in one of these three domains. Okay. And so, and we find out that their depression, when we start talking about what domain it is not mysterious as to what's happening. They are receiving failure feedback in that domain. I have never had anybody come in and say, I'm so depressed, I don't know what's going on, I keep winning the Super Bowl every year. Nobody says that. Okay? So it's always as the result of the following issue. Human beings calibrate their expectations for themselves relative to what they see other people of similar abilities accomplish. So this is how we set goals. So if you're a pretty good little tennis player, you don't set the goal to be the next Andre Agassi. That's not what you do. But you might want to make the varsity at your high school. And so as a result, what happens is that we set goals for what we think we can achieve in terms of impressing people in the social environment by our achievements. And then we seek to do the things necessary to try to display those characteristics to the marketplace. When we fall short of our expectations, that's disappointing. And if we continue to fall short repeatedly, we get frustrated and eventually depressed. And depression is a mechanism of lowered esteem signaling. In other words, we are getting signals from the environment that they do not esteem us as much as we would hope and we expected, and therefore depression is a necessary signal that encourages us to quit doing what we've been doing and quit putting energies into a losing cause. Okay? This is part of a more universal principle in animal motivation, which is to depress or reduce the amount of energy output on a target goal if it's unlikely to be productive. And so if you have, if you were told to, put the Wall Street Journal under your arm and start door knocking to look for a job, and you did that, and 67 doors later and 3 weeks later, nobody was interested in hiring you, you should be depressed. And it would be a biological catastrophe if you were not depressed. You should be depressed, because the depression is a signal to you that you are getting consistent failure feedback with this strategy, and you should, in fact, try to not continue that strategy. So feelings of, quote, low self-esteem are feelings that result from feedback from the social environment that indicates that our efforts at displaying our essentially what people do is they advertise a value proposition to the marketplace, either in mating or in friendships or in trade. What you're trying to do is you're trying to establish a relationship of exchange with one of those three classes of individuals. So to make this very untechnical, if Bob wants to date Sue, he is essentially displaying for her or advertising a value proposition. And if she does not want to buy, then that is failure feedback, and he's going to be disappointed. If he then goes to Mary, which he may go to Mary because Mary is the second most desirable person for him, and she rejects him, then he's going to be disappointed again. If he then goes to Karen, who is one notch down further, and he fails again, pretty soon our boy's starting to be depressed. Okay, and the depression is a signal that says, don't walk around chewing tobacco and spitting on her shoes before you ask her out for the movies on Saturday night. In other words, he's going to start to try to figure out what he's doing wrong and stop the action as to what he's doing now because he's receiving failure feedback.
This is very good. This is very good. I'm on my to-do list. Stop chewing tobacco and spitting it on my date shoes. So that explains Sunday night.
That explains it. You got it. So what we do as people is we advertise. because all three of these domains of life are actually under what we're going to call competitive pressure. So you can't just mate with who you want, and you can't just be friends with who you want, and you can't just do the things that you want in trade. It doesn't work that way. There are people with desirable characteristics that will not want to trade with you because they want to trade with somebody else. And so I don't care if you're Michael Jordan. Eventually they got rid of Michael Jordan out of Chicago. He got too old, and they didn't think they could win with him, and he wasn't worth the money, and they let him go. Okay, so it doesn't matter who you are. You are always under competitive pressure from other people, and you are trying to advertise your wares as to what you can trade in competition with other people. And I must say, you know, I don't mind taking pot shots at fellow psychologists without naming them, maybe specifically, of course. But psychology is notorious, particularly clinical psychology, the people that try to actually help people. They are notorious for putting their heads in the sand about the concept of competition. For example, I mean, even Nathaniel Brandon, as fine a thinker as he was in many ways in the self-esteem arena, he thought of self-esteem as something that had nothing to do with competition with other people, that he likened it to physical health, and that physical health was not competitive with other people, and he said psychological health would mean high self-esteem, and therefore that's not have anything to do with other people. Well, he was just flat out totally wrong. It has everything to do with other people. The psychological health does not have to do with self-esteem, and that was a big misunderstanding. The psychological health might have to do with tremendous disease processes like schizophrenia, or possibly somebody has, terrible seizure disorders that cause all kinds of problems. I mean, we're talking about structural, architectural problems with the brain. That is a whole different issue. That is psychological health at that level. Or you could also argue that people who have genetically mediated bizarre anomalies that are very problematic, obsessive-compulsive disorder, et cetera, that people can be highly functional, but they can do an awful lot of suffering. And you could, in principle, call that psychologically unhealthy, but it's a little strange way to put it. But low self-esteem is not a sign of bad psychological health. It's a sign of failure feedback. And this was a big misunderstanding on Brandon's part. And it is highly interdependent with signaling from other people, and it's all about competition. And it's all about the signaling that we get, or what we're going to call esteem cues from other people, that tell us about how valuable we are.
Okay. This is very interesting because this is kind of contrary to what we hear on Dr. Phil and Oprah and all the other shows. And so if we can talk a little bit about, like, what are some of the key ingredients? Can you, before actually we get to that, if anybody wants to call in for any questions, the number is 657-383-0751. Feel free to call in, and we'll get to you when we can. Again, the number is 657-383-0751. If you're listening on the website, you can go in the chat room and just go under a guest, and just you can type some questions in as well. I'm reading those as well. So it seems a little contrary to what we've been hearing with all the pop psychology and the reality shows and things like that. The question I have is, can you give someone good self-esteem?
No, you can't. The truth is that self-esteem, as I said, there's these two mystical parts of self-esteem that have not been understood. But by the time we're done here in a little while, people will have an understanding of this. First of all, the number one ingredient of the self-esteem mechanism is this tracking mechanism of the cues that we have from other people. And so self-esteem also, as we can see, is not global. It isn't universal across three domains. It's actually highly domain-specific. So someone could have, for example, be very highly esteemed at their work, being well-paid, well-regarded, highly respected. Okay? they could actually even have very good friends who think that they're terrific and conscientious and fine person. And they could be getting bad feedback in the mating arena and be really frustrated, possibly that they've got their sight set, maybe they're a 5 on a 1 to 10 scale for sexual attractiveness, and they really think because they're such a fine person and well-compensated and outstanding individual that they deserve a 7 or 8 in the looks arena, and they can't get it. And as a result, they may be very frustrated with that situation and quite depressed about it when they are in those arenas or in those situations. And so as a result, feel the low self-esteem as the self-esteem goes off, as the esteem meter fires off and tells them once again that they were rejected by a 7. That they thought that they should qualify for and didn't. Unhappy, and they're spending hours and minutes, minutes and hours in a depressed state as a result of the failure feedback. And so this is how it is that now we're clarifying what has been essentially preliminary and floppy understanding of what self-esteem is. And we start cleaning it up and realizing, oh no, it's much more specific than this. You can absolutely feel very confident and valued and appropriately treated in the marketplace in one domain and not feel that in another domain. And so we see now that self-esteem is not carved in stone inside of you as a general overall feeling about what you think about yourself, but it's in fact highly domain specific, particularly to these three domains. And people, someone who has great friends and a great mate, but is unemployed and getting a bunch of negative feedback in the marketplace, can be very depressed and frustrated about that situation. So, so now what we're going to do is we're going to move through into another place here, which is let's think about that. What people do is they advertise their what they have to display. And trade with other people. So they display in the mating arena. It's standard operating procedure throughout the animal kingdom to make displays such as singing, dancing, athletics, beauty, and houses. Those five are very universal throughout the animal kingdom. You will see a beautiful plumage. You will see beautiful sculpted bodies. You will see athletic competitions. You will see housing, in other words, the best houses and nests in a particular habitat for a particular species are under high competitive pressure, and therefore only the most fit animals can get those things. That would be the equivalent of, the fancy house at the top of the hill in Beverly Hills. Like, you better be a pretty fit organism to get the resources to be able to get that house. And if you did get it, that is a signal of something important. That is also true in the animal kingdom. So those are some very prominent things in the mating arena, but not so much in, for example, trade or friendship. So in trade and friendship, people are more signaling things like personality characteristics, how conscientious, how kind, how intelligent, how social, things of this nature. These are these basic personality characteristics that people signal, and they'll do that on job interviews, and they'll say, well, what's your weakness? And they'll say, well, sometimes I'm just, I get so lost in doing things perfectly that I lose a little time perspective. Yeah, the only thing that you can afford to admit is being a perfectionist, for God's sakes. So
it's almost like you were there with me at the job interview.
There you go. So this is what people do, and they're making displays with everything. With their haircuts, with their clothes, with their cars, with their careers, with their country clubs, how many carrots they have on their hand, everything that you see, people are trying to display these characteristics in order to be competitive with respect to trades and potential trades in the marketplace for mates, friends, and trading partners. Now, where it is, so essentially what I'm going to argue is that a very important feeling in life is the sensitivity that we have to esteem cues from other people. So I'm going to call this esteem as opposed to self-esteem. Now, people will interchange two very different concepts that we're going to be discussing. The first is the one thing that I'm going to call esteem. And Mark Leary, when he examined us, when people asked about how they felt about their self-esteem after they got rejected from other people, they said, oh, my self-esteem is low. But, in fact, I will argue that that is not the self-esteem mechanism. I will argue that that is an esteem mechanism. And we interchangeably use two different concepts, and we're going to see the second concept in a minute. And this has been part of the confusion throughout the history of psychology. It's been about that there are actually two very different mechanisms, esteem mechanisms, but they feel the same. So one of them is going to be, in fact, for example, if let's say some attractive woman, you know, flirts with you, you're going to, you can walk away and tell your friend, wow, that was good for my ego. Okay? Now, so the ego, quote, that word is the word we use for Mark Leary's sociometer, or what I'm going to call an esteem meter. Okay, so if you get rejected for three job interviews, you say, wow, that's tough on my ego. So we actually have a word in our language for this mechanism because the processes that it accomplishes are so important, and the word is ego. Okay? Now, however, what we're going to do is we're going to look slightly differently at this process. We're going to say, okay, but there seems to be something else besides what other people think of me that seems to be acting inside of me. And that is sometimes other people don't have to be even around and I have feelings. So, for example, if I put on a suit in the mirror at Macy's and nobody else is around, I say, whoa, that looks pretty good on me. We might say, ooh, I feel my self-esteem rising. Okay? And you do. And now we're going to look at what this is. So human beings, in order to advertise their wares to the marketplace, they were better off if they rehearsed. So, for example, let's suppose in some ancient environment, right at the dawn of language, you know, some guy that said, you know, to some girl at an ancient dance, you know, ooh, stars, me, you, you know. That guy got laid because he was the first guy that pointed to the stars and, you know, tried to bring that into the conversation. But a few hundred thousand years later, you better be better than that. So you better be thinking before you go up to the girl what you're going to say to her. You know, you just don't walk up there and say, oh, where'd you get that bone in your hair? You don't say that, okay? You try to say something clever. You know, what's your sign? Something. Try to say something that's going to be interesting. And the way that you're going to figure out that what's going to be interesting is you're going to have a little facsimile of her brain sitting inside your head. You're going to have a little, let's suppose her name's Guga, okay? So you've got a little Guga in your head, and you're thinking, if I see this, what do I think? No, I think she'll frown. What about this? No, that's, oh, what about, oh, that's funny. That'll be good, okay? So you essentially play the situation in your mind's eye before it ever happens. You rehearse it. So human beings, turn out, are the great rehearsers. They rehearse and they rehearse and they rehearse and they rehearse and they rehearse. So they rehearse before they go out on a date. They put on different clothes. They look at this thing, the situation in the mirror. They look at infinitesimal differences in their appearance from different angles in the mirror. They change their hair a little bit. They put on a different color coordinated this or that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're rehearsing. In order to rehearse, you have to have a mechanism inside your head that's anticipating what other people think. And this is going to be what I call the internal audience. So the internal audience is a mechanism that is a specialized set of neural tissue that effectively acts as if other people are watching you. And that mechanism, what it does is just as if other people were watching you and giving you esteem signals as to whether they liked your advertisement or not, the internal audience will do the same thing. It will give you positive feedback and will give you negative feedback. Now, this has been noticed in the history of psychology. So cognitive therapy, which is the most researched, most respected therapeutic process on the planet for psychology, they actually call it the internal critic. And here they make a mistake. The internal audience is not a critic. You could say that it's a critic in the most precise use of the term, i.e. a critic can either be positive or negative in its feedback, but the cognitive therapists are not thinking of it in that way. They think of that the human beings have a pesky, critical, internal voice, and that you have to figure out how to talk back to it and to challenge it, etc. Here they make a mistake. It is not a critic. The internal audience is an audience, and it will applaud you if you do a good job in your rehearsal, and it will criticize you if you do a lousy job in your rehearsal. This is what I'm going to call the self-esteem mechanism. The self-esteem mechanism is the social psychological process that takes place inside of your own mind. And the reason why we evolved such a mechanism is to give us feedback during rehearsal. So you can imagine if you could think of a clever thing to say to the pretty girl, then how much more confidence you would feel walking up there and motivated to do it. Whereas if you could not think of anything really clever to say, you might just keep your mouth shut because your internal audience says you don't have anything intelligent to say. Okay? So through this method, through an internal audience, the internal audience signals the esteem mechanism or the ego in the same way that real-life social feedback from real-life people will signal it. Now, this is self-esteem, and this is what people were trying to say and Nathaniel Branden was trying to say when he said, look, only you can give it to yourself. Okay? So, and he is correct. That only you, but you can't, people that misunderstand that you should just say positive things to yourself about yourself. This is absurd. The self-esteem mechanism is a very sophisticated audience. If you just try to say positive things about yourself, it couldn't care less, okay? The self-esteem mechanism is sensitive to observing your rehearsals and how well you do at rehearsal. If you work really hard and are diligent and you do a good job, even if nobody else has seen it, your internal audience says, good job, you worked really hard. If you do a half-baked job and cheat on your diet and and then you try to stand in front of the mirror and try to give yourself positive self-affirmations, it's a totally worthless process. The self-esteem mechanism is not fooled. The internal audience couldn't care less, and it will give you the same mediocre feedback that it gave you yesterday. So it turns out that you actually have indirect control over an enormously important component of your happiness, which is your self-esteem mechanism. You have no control, really, over whether other people will ever accept you, ever value what it is that you do, ever want to mate with you, ever want to be your friend, or ever hire you. Of course, you've got some indirect control over it. You can hustle and try to figure out what other people do that works, and success leaves clues. So it turns out you can get coaching and advice and liposuction and whatever. Okay, there are ways to battle the competitive problems that people have. However, we do not have very much control over whether or not we will ever be able to achieve the positive feedback that we think we might deserve from the marketplace. So our esteem meter may not fire over a lifetime in the way that we would hope. On the other hand, it may fire completely adequately as we reach goals that we think we deserve, and we do reach them. So, but what we do have control over is the self-esteem mechanism, which is about 50% of your happiness. You have the ability to actually earn on a daily basis the internal audience's regard from diligent, excellent effort. And that thing, I have to tell you, is merciless. This is where people that are very talented and attractive but get a tremendous amount of positive feedback from the world for who it is that they are and what they look like, these people can actually have low self-esteem, which seems incredible that would be true, but it can. And they can have very high esteem. They can enjoy the fact that they're adored by other people, and that can feel very good when that is happening. But in their quiet moments, when they are really not proud of who it is that they are, and they have not done a good job of actualizing their potential, and they haven't been a very good person, then they rightly and appropriately may have very low self-esteem experiences and can only be corrected by excellent, diligent effort. That is the only way that it is corrected. But it is beautiful to know that we actually have a pitiless democratic and very civil mechanism inside of us that is largely responsible for how it is that we feel for most of the hours of our life.
That is that's very interesting. So so basically, if someone compliments you over and over and over again and gives you all this positive feedback, but you internally know that you really didn't deserve it, that will not result in self-esteem. Am I understanding that
right?
Not
at all. Not at all. In fact, it's worse than that. We could talk another time, Nate, if you have me back, on traps that are set up for the self-esteem mechanism when that happens. So if people are could sense this in their children, if they're encouraging their children about how great their children are, and their children are in fact self-destructing right in front of them or highly demotivated and are playing video games and not doing their math homework, go to my website at esteemdynamics.org, and there is material on there about that that I will explain that process. The self-esteem mechanism can be put under bizarre pressure when expectations are put that are too high, and as a result, all the positive feedback in the world is actually usually a disaster for the self-esteem process. The feedback to your children should be, you know, what I would call, you know, 110% of the truth. In other words, the truth plus a little extra nice gentle frosting, not 200% of the truth or 400% of the truth, which is what is a standard operating procedure these days. That telling little kids that they can be great and that they can reach these high heights, this does not motivate them, it demotivates them. Instead, what we want to do is we want to be really quite honest and pretty accurate but gentle about that accuracy. And if we do that and we keep it right there, that's the best results for us and anybody else.
So what advice would you give someone who either wanted to boost or develop their own self-esteem or wanted to develop self-esteem with someone else?
Yes. What we would want to do is we would want to, number one, figure out which domain of life, whether it's mating, friendship, or trade, that you feel like you are not achieving as much as you would expect that you should be able to. So the domain of life which is most frustrating for you. And then what we're going to do is we're going to make a study of that domain and try to assess why it is that the market is not biting as hard on what we have to offer as we think they should. And we're going to try to figure out what that is. And a lot of times what that is that there's some work and some hustle and some effort that is associated with what our competitors are doing, who are maybe no more genetically endowed than us in some domain, what they're doing versus what we are doing. That we may be just as talented and beautiful as people that are doing better than we are, but we are only putting out 70% of the effort, or we are not being as effective. And so we need to then essentially analyze that problem and then realize that we may have some things to learn and some things that we may need to develop and some conditions that we may need to improve. We may need to be in better financial condition, better physical condition. We may be need to be in better intellectual condition. We may need to be, you know, essentially being more knowledgeable about something or more skillful in order to be more competitive. And so it usually breaks down to what we're going to call, what I call the fundamentals. That if you're a basketball team that just got beat up by another basketball team and you desperately would like to be competitive with them, you don't just hope and pray and swear up and down and jump up and down. There are fundamental actions that team did, and they did them better than you did them. And the reason they did them better than you did them is that they practiced more than you did. And they practiced more effectively, and they spent more time and energy in learning the requisite skills needed to do that job well. That is true whether or not you are a basketball player, your piano player, math teacher, cutting hair, or you're a businessman that's trying to sell tacos. There are fundamentals to what it is that you are trying to do. And if you are not doing well in the marketplace and your feeling of esteem is suffering behind this, then your job is to figure out what those fundamentals are and put time and energy and resources into trying to improve your competitive standing. That is what you do. And when you do that process, your self-esteem mechanism rises as it appreciates the effort that you put in. You will then get an enormous boost if you actually get esteem signals from the marketplace where that improves. Okay, but the first thing that we care about is self-esteem. Self-esteem is immediately dynamic in that as you break the problems down and address them and face what it is that you can do about them and you start to do whatever that is about them, you will start to feel better about yourself almost immediately. I had a woman, I'll tell you a story before we close. I had a woman that texted me about 5 years ago, one of my good clients who, good-humored, bright, pretty lady, midlife, and she struggles with being self-indulgent and gaining weight eating. And she goes up and down, and I've seen her go up and down, you know, over 20 years. When she loses weight, she's very attractive and very self-confident, and then she gains 30 pounds, and then she feels bad about herself, disgusted, and back and forth it goes. And she texted me, and she said, Dr. Doug, I need a quick fix. I feel down, disgusted, and with myself, and I'm fat again, and I just need you to say something, and I just don't feel like, you know, eating a bunch of vegetables today. I just don't feel like that's going to do it for me if I do that. And what I said to her is I texted her back. I said, the fastest way to improve your self-esteem is to exercise vigorously. You go to the gym and you work out, and I want you to work out really, really hard until your muscles are tired and sore and you're exhausted. Because if you do that, when it's midnight, you cannot give it back. Whereas if you ate really well for the next two meals and ate a bunch of rice and vegetables and thought you'd been a good girl, you could blow the whole thing by eating a bunch of ice cream at midnight. So your internal audience does not believe that you deserve any pat on the back just because you did a good job by eating a couple of healthy meals. But your internal audience will respect you if you go into the gym and work out really hard. Because if you do that, you know you did it. Your internal audience knows you did it. And no matter what you eat after that, it knows that you made a tremendous effort. Okay? She texted me back. I wrote this all up in, you know, a couple of paragraphs. And she said, fantastic. I feel so much better. I don't even have to go to the gym.
Mission accomplished.
It was a thing of beauty, okay? But the fun thing about it for me was it was clearly hitting what I call her source code. It was right down inside of her neural circuits. It was accurate. And that is correct, that she could actually imagine doing the exercise and imagine what her internal audience would feel, and it was correct. She would have felt really good about herself.
So she solved the problem. So for her, it seems like the main motivation was just to find a solution to the problem. And once the solution exists, then there's no need to
No need to put out any effort. She felt
fine. It reminds me of a joke where, you know, a mathematician is in a hotel room with an engineer, and the hotel lobby is on fire, and the engineer comes out and he says, "I'm going to go get the fire extinguisher." The mathematician looks outside and he says, "Oh, I see where the fire started. Okay, I can go back to bed now." So, you know, for him, the solution exists. He knows where it came from now. He doesn't have to stress as much.
That's right. There you go.
So in general, for the fundamentals for mates, friends, or trading partners or business, one of the fundamentals I just heard you say was basically go to the gym or go exercise vigorously. Are there any other fundamentals that are specific to either of these three processes? Are there these three relationships?
Oh, certainly. All three of them have their own fundamentals. So in the case of attractiveness, going to the gym is a fundamental because the better physical condition that you are in, the more attractive that you are. And so if you do the hard work associated with that, you will feel better about yourself even before anybody ever says anything. So long before you get any esteem from other people, you will get self-esteem from the internal audience who recognizes that you are doing an effective rehearsal. Okay? The same thing is true if you are, for example, struggling professionally. So let's suppose you're a financial guy and you went to school and you majored in finance from, Arizona State, and you're kind of having a hard time getting a job and you're kind of depressed about it and you're feeling the competitive pressure. But now you find out that, if you do this exam called System 7 or whatever the heck it is, and, it's going to be a whole bunch of work. Well, if you sit down and realize, I got 5 months work to do here, and the first night you sit down and you work for 4 hours on that and you test yourself and you see that you learned a lot, your internal audience says, well done, Joe, okay? And your self-esteem starts to rise immediately. So, and you do it 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, 6 nights in a row, within 2 weeks, your self-esteem can be much higher. Even though we're a long ways away from passing our System 7 exam, we can see that that we have what it takes to do it because we've done little bits of it, and there's nothing about the later bits that is any different or more complicated than the early bits. And so essentially the process, it's a universal process of understanding that all major achievements, all big achievements are nothing other than small achievements accumulated. That's all they are. There is no one giant achievement. There is no such thing. Human achievements are always the result of little achievements, and little achievements are that happen literally 1 second at a time as we put our effort on trying to figure out the math problem, or we put our effort on trying to figure out how we hold the snow ski pole. Every little bit of human achievement is literally done 1 second at a time. And if we make those efforts diligently to try to improve our competitive standing in any arena, our self-esteem will rise automatically. We literally have an indirect lever over how it is that we feel about ourselves.
Thank you again for coming on, Dr. Lyle.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.